Good morning, everyone. We're ready to begin. We've left off in Leviticus 3. That is probably not where we'll start this morning because we've read the text already. But we've been going through the offerings of the law. We've considered two broad classes of offering, voluntary offerings and mandatory offerings. The voluntary ones so far that we've looked at include the olah, the burnt offering, and the shalem, the peace offering. These are offerings that would have been given, again, on a voluntary basis, at least at the individual level. They're given on a voluntary basis as you have been prospered, as you've been blessed. Excuse me. They would sometimes fit specific occasions. So, for example, we find peace, you know, sacrifices being made for example, whenever Laban and Jacob secure their covenant not to attack each other in their respective places after Jacob flees. We've been studying the peace offering specifically, and we've got just a few things to finish up on the peace offering. All right, so let's ignore that for just a second. Looking at the burnt offering and the peace offering, what's the big difference between those two offerings? What's the main thing? Okay, the peace offering gets eaten. What happens to the burnt offering? It is a whole offering. Yeah, the entire thing is burnt and offered up to the Lord. Now, both of these are meant to be means of drawing near to the Lord, right? One of the Hebrew words for sacrifice is korban. You probably recognize that from the New Testament. And it comes from this Hebrew root karav, which means to draw near, right? So the sense of a sacrifice is that you are giving of yourself, to maintain or establish or closen a relationship with the Lord. All right, we'll find some examples of that in just a minute. There's a couple that I want to look at. The peace offering specifically is referred to as a zevach. And it's just another word for sacrifice, but it has a slightly different connotation to it. And often in the Old Testament, we find this as a covenant meal. All right, as it's commanded in Leviticus, we receive some other instructions elsewhere for it. In this covenant meal, you bring the offering forward. You know, you slaughter the offering, just like you would any other offering. But then the priest only takes out the fatty bits of the animal to put on the altar of burnt offering. And so the Lord receives the fat of the offering as his portion. The priest, as his portion, receives the breast, the right thigh, and one of the loaves of bread that's supposed to accompany the offering. So remember, all of these offerings, besides having the animal, also have a grain offering of some sort, and usually a drink offering, although the peace offering is a little bit different. In the burnt offering, what kind of grain offering do you have to offer? I'll give you a hint. It's the sort of grain offering that you almost always see offered under the law of Moses, including in the Passover. What's the one stipulation for your grain? Unleavened. It can't be leavened. And the standard grain offering is unleavened. With the peace offering, it's a little different. The peace offering is offered with loaves of leavened bread. And one of those loaves goes to the priest. All right, now, for the peace offering, you can offer out of the herd, out of the flock, or you can offer goats. So let's imagine you're offering out of the herd. So you're offering a bull or a heifer, and that's a large meal, is it not? that's a huge amount of meat left over. All right, the priest gets the breast and the right thigh. That's a large portion already. But then you've got the rest of the animal left. What happens to the rest of the animal? Yeah, it's eaten, okay, by you, and who else? Family, yeah. The Levite, yeah, and that's, I don't think we read that in the commands in Leviticus. We instead read that in Deuteronomy 12. That the Levite who lives in your town also should be invited to this covenant meal because, and this is what the Lord says with all of the provisions for the Levites, because the Levite has no inheritance, right? The Levite doesn't really own anything. I mean, he's going to have a house in whatever city he lives in. He's probably going to have a small plot of ground, but it's not a family plot. Excuse me, right? This is not something that he can, you know, like the rest of the tribes, they get these huge tracts of land to split up at the clan level. The Levites don't have that. The Levites are essentially, well, they have to be a protected class because the Lord has set them apart for specific work. All right, so the Levite is to be provided for. Now, we looked at one example of a peace offering that is made during the Feast of Weeks. And at least during that time, again, we don't know if this is generalized to all of the peace offerings or if it is only contained during the Feast of Weeks. But at least during the Feast of Weeks, who else was to join in your peace offering other than your immediate family and any Levites living around you? Yes. Yeah, the protected classes, the widow, the fatherless, the sojourner who's in your land. So this becomes a mechanism for taking care of those protected classes. Now, again, we don't know if that generalizes to all of the peace offerings, or if the, so in other words, is the silence there a restrictive silence or a loosening silence, right? Would Israel if you were an Israelite, would you get in trouble for inviting a poor person to your peace offering outside of the Feast of Weeks? That, again, we don't have anything explicit in Scripture on that. So it is a possibility. At the very least, during the Feast of Weeks, it would happen. So during this covenant meal, all of these parties are being drawn together. Excuse me. And in some places, as we'll see, it's used to formalize the covenant. In most places, it's just used to maintain and symbolize the strength of that covenant. Right? And by the way, we still do this kind of thing today, don't we? Like, you don't think of it in these terms, right? That I'm going to go offer a sacrifice, and we're all going to eat it together. Instead, it's just, hey, I'm going to go to I'm going to a wedding and I'm going to join the reception afterward. Right? You don't get to see them kill the bull, but you get to eat it. and it is a covenant meal, right? It's a meal celebrating the covenants that's just been formed between the bride and the groom. State dinners are the same way. Usually there's like business dinners for business deals. We still engage in this kind of practice today, right? Lots of agreements and covenants are formed over the table. Excuse me. All right, so that is the basic sense of the peace offering. Now, I want to look at some specific examples of where burnt offerings and peace offerings are made in the formation of the covenant. So go to Exodus chapter 24. And I just want to show how this functions in terms of formalizing the covenant. Excuse me. Now, remember what's just happened in Exodus up to this point. All right, they've been traveling to Mount Sinai. They get there in the chapters beforehand, and they have received the commandments concerning the mountain. Don't touch it or you'll die. If any of your livestock wanders onto it, the livestock have to die. And by the way, how do they have to be put to death? Do you guys remember? Yeah, at a distance, right? Because God's holiness has rubbed off on them and you cannot touch them. right? They have to be put to death from a distance. But finally, Moses goes up on the mountain and he receives the commandments. And that's what we read starting in chapter 20 through chapter 23. That's a big, big chunk of the law that we will focus on a lot in this study. Then in chapter 24, we find the covenant being confirmed. Let's start in chapter 24, verse 3. Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules. And all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do." All right, there's an affirmation. We are going to obey what the Lord has said. And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. He rose early in the morning, built an altar at the foot of the mountain, and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the people of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. All right, and there we have the formalizing sacrifices. All right, it's been delivered, and now they offer burnt offerings, and the shalamim, the peace offerings. Wayne? That is, yeah, this is, yes. So Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he threw against the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, "All that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient." And Moses took the blood and threw it on the people and said, "Behold the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." All right, we always bring out the blood part. All right, it's the symbol of the covenant being formed between the Lord and Israel. But of course, where does the blood come from? It comes from the burnt offerings and the peace offerings that are being made. All right, so, and again, we shouldn't just imagine that these are just animals being killed and just wholly burnt up. That's the burnt offering, but the peace offering would have included a meal, because that's the meaning of it. You offer a peace offering and it is consumed. Excuse me. Now, all of the burnt offerings and peace offerings that Israel offers after this, it might be an overstatement to say that they are reenactments of what's going on here, but they are at the very least a memorial of what's going on here. In fact, we see a pretty close parallel with our own observance of the Lord's Supper, right? We're not crucifying Christ over again. But we are being reminded of what happened with the symbols, with the bread and with the juice. All of the burnt offerings and peace offerings made after this, again, are reminders. This is how the Lord has drawn us close to Himself. And as you make those offerings in the future, you continue to draw near to the Lord. You affirm at least your participation in that covenant and your faithfulness to that covenant. Now, how good is Israel at remaining faithful to their covenants? Pretty awful. And what we find is that Israel also does a pretty good job of perverting the sacrifices as they are perverting their relationship with the Lord. Right, these go hand in hand, the sacrifices and the relationship with God. And where you find Israel's relationship with God going south, you also find their sacrifices going south. And they do some really wonky things with their sacrifices at points. We talked about Jephthah a little bit on Thursday, and about his burnt offering. Right, and again, the natural idea of a burnt offering is that you are giving something voluntarily to God. And Jephthah's vow, you know, at the first sounds like, oh, that's a nice vow. He's willing to give of anything that he has. And then at the end of the story, you realize, wait a minute, that was a really stupid thing for him to say, that he's going to offer literally anything, whatever first comes out of his door. He should have repented of the rash vow. And we'll read the commandment concerning that, I think, today, if we've got time. It has to do with the sin offering. But there's an offering that Jephthah could have offered to get out of that rash vow. Instead, what does he do? He offers his daughter as a burnt offering. He follows through on it. And it's a sign of what's going on more broadly in Israel, because how is Israel's relationship with the Lord going? Not great, right? Judges is like the low point of Israel, right? Judges is the worst of the worst. Excuse me. Well, we likewise find Israel perverting these sacrifices, these very sacrifices that they just made at the foot of the mountain, almost immediately after Moses has gone up. Go to Exodus 32. All right, we know the story of Exodus 32. I just want us to read it through the lens of what we're studying right now and see what jumps out at you. Exodus 32, verse 1. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make for us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." So Aaron said to them, "Take off the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. All right. And by the way, how much time has passed between Exodus 24 and Exodus 32? How long was Moses up on the mountain for? 40 days. We're talking... Yeah, we don't know exactly at what point. I think we're to understand this is at the end of Moses' time on the mountain. So it's been a month and a handful of days. And they've gone from ratifying this covenant with God to now attempting to ratify another covenant. I don't know what's going on here, because they're upset that Moses is gone. They want Aaron to make gods for them. And so Aaron makes this golden image. But then who does Aaron proclaim the image to be? Yeah, the God of Israel. Yeah, he proclaims a feast to the Lord. And then what do? They try to reconsummate this covenant that they've already made with the Lord, except now they're reconsummating it to this idol. And they're offering burnt offerings and peace offerings. And that's where the meal is coming from, when it says that the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And that's the observance of the peace offering. Tom? Yeah. Yes. Right. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Right. Let's bring them in and say they belong to God. Yeah. Yeah.
They didn't have to tell them to come back and they burn those golden idols.
Yeah. You got to pulverize them. Yep.
They're going to keep going back.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the central irony of this. In that first set of sacrifices in Exodus 24, what are they supposed to be doing? I mean, they're supposed to be consummating this relationship with God. They are supposed to be drawing near to the Lord. And it's evident When you get to Exodus 32, they have not done that, right? You've got the outward sign of it, but you don't have the inward change, right? The sacrifices, at least for Israel, ended up signifying nothing. They ended up being of no effect for them. Wayne? In chapter 24, don't think we got that far, no. Mm-hmm, about Moses and Aaron and the rest going up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you find another covenant meal there. You don't find a sacrifice being made in this passage, but it's a covenant meal. Yeah. Again, the word zavach is not used in this passage, but I think we're to understand it as a covenant meal between Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and the elders and the Lord. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Who they claim to be the old God, but for some reason they also feel like they need to have a new ceremony to consummate this relationship with the God that they've already consummated their relationship. I mean, sin makes you do things that don't make sense, right? Tom, did I see your hand again? Yeah. Yes. Yep. Oh yeah. Exactly. Yes. To do something pleasing. Yep, exactly. I want to play off of what you were saying earlier about how this continues to be a problem even for Christians today, because as we look at specifically the peace offerings, the idea of a zavach, a covenant meal sacrificed to God, if we had to reach for a New Testament parallel to that, what's the most obvious choice? The Lord's Supper. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So let's start by going to Luke chapter 22. All right, because we're going to find that the Lord's Supper makes a lot of sense in these terms. Right? Everything in the Old Testament is foreshadowing what is to come under Christ. And so in what we have received is the church, we find echoes of what existed under the law. And so you go to Luke 22, and we'll start in verse 14. When the hour came, he reclined at table, and the apostles with him. And he said to them, I have earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I tell you that I will not eat it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God. And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he said, take this and divide it among yourselves. For I tell you that from now on I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes. And he took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, this is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And likewise the cup after they had eaten, saying, this cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood. But behold, the hand of him who betrays me is with me at the table. I want us to stop and focus on that idea. This cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood. Right? We should hear the echoes of what happens under Moses in this language. Because what does Moses do in Exodus 24? He formalizes the covenant with the blood. Right? It is the blood of the covenant. And Christ proclaims this cup that we partake of is the new covenant in his blood. Right? What we're participating in here is a covenant meal. And it fills a lot of the same functions. If you go to 1 Corinthians 11, or actually let's start in 1 Corinthians 10, because Paul has some things to say there about the Lord's Supper as well. All right, remember, he's warning against idolatry. This is in the context of that broader discussion about meat sacrificed to idols. In 1 Corinthians 10, starting in verse 14, he says, "Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing that we bless, is it not a participation in the blood of Christ? And the bread that we break, is it not a participation in the body of Christ?" All right, talking Lord's Supper here. "Because there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread." Right, already we can hear echoes of the sacrificial meal here, because what does the peace offering do? It brings the family together, along with the Levite, along with potentially other parties, along with the priest and the Lord. "There is one bread. We who partake of it are one body, because we partake of one bread. Consider the people of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices participants in the altar?" All right, now Paul is making an explicit connection here. He says, think back to those offerings. When you make that offering, you are a participant at the altar. What do I imply then? That food offered to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No, I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they offer to demons and not to God. I do not want you to be participants with demons. Right. In other words, Paul understands, we'll finish this passage. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake in the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Shall we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? All right, and hopefully we hear all the echoes of what we've just read in the law here. All right, participation with demons by eating at the table of demons. All right, this is, again, he's referring us back to this idea of the covenant meal. And so the Lord's Supper, again, is the true covenant meal. It's the meal of the true covenant where we draw near to God. We participate in what the Lord has offered us. All right, and that's why, when you get to 1 Corinthians 11, Paul is upset that they have perverted this sacrifice. Before we read that, go ahead, Tom. Yeah. And see Moses and Elijah. Yeah. Yeah. This is my son. Listen to him. Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is, this, from what I received from the Lord, I delivered unto you.
Yes.
That makes a lot of importance when you tie yes. these things together, because back to what we said is here. Mm-hmm. You know, Moses received from the Lord, he wrote those things down, he delivered them to the people,
yes.
he will obey.
Exactly.
And now we come in what the Lord did.
And we're in the same position. Yeah, we're in the same position. We have received what has been given by the Lord. And it comes down to, will we commit to obey or not? Right? So you find these perversions being made in 1 Corinthians 11. Right? Verse 17, "In the following instructions, I do not commend you, because when you come together, it is not for the better, but for the worse. For in the first place, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you. And I believe it in part. For there must be factions among you in order that those who are genuine among you may be recognized. When you come together, it is not the Lord's Supper that you eat. For in eating, each one goes ahead with his own meal. One goes hungry, another gets drunk. What, do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and humiliate those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I commend you for this? No, I will not. Right, and we could go on even further, right, talking about the symbols, or later in the chapter, this warning that you need to examine yourself and partake of the supper in a worthy manner, or that you partake of judgment against yourself. I want to pick up what he says in verse 22. What, do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Again, this is not just some normal meal where you're just sitting around your own table eating as you please. It is the Lord's meal. Do you despise the church of God and humiliate those who have nothing? That's an interesting thing for Paul to say. And I think that it makes sense whenever you understand it, again, in terms of the covenant meal that's already been laid down, right? If we understand the Lord's Supper as the Christian fulfillment of this covenant meal. Again, what's one of the purposes of the covenant meal? Well, what happens with the rest? It's not just you that's eating it. You also have an obligation, at the very least, to take care of your own servants. You have an obligation to take care of the Levite. And in certain circumstances, you have the obligation to take care of the widow, the fatherless, and the sojourner with this meal. Do you humiliate those who have nothing? And so he does not commend them for what they have done. All right. So, and then again, this is one of the main thrusts of this study, is that I want us to be able to use the law as a tool for helping us understand the significance of what we have in Jesus Christ. Because again, all of this is pointing forward. All of this is meant to be fulfilled and consummated in Jesus Christ. And so I think having an understanding of these things helps us to appreciate what we have better. Wayne? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we instinctively understand the association between those two. They are indeed separate commandments, right? Let's not confuse that. They are separate commandments. But we are not under any compulsion to put them next to each other in the worship assembly, right? We could take the collection first and have the Lord's Supper last. I don't think I've ever been to a church that's done that, though. We always associate those two things, and we say it's a matter of convenience. I don't know, maybe it is. But whenever you pass from the supper to the collection, you can see conceptually how they are connected. Again, they're separate commandments, but in the first part, in the supper, we are considering, we're commemorating the way that the Lord has sacrificed for us and the benefits that we receive for it. And then we immediately turn around and ask all of us to sacrifice on behalf of others, right? Give this offering. As the Lord has offered, so should you offer. Again, they're separate commandments. I don't want to try to bleed one into the other. But that doesn't mean that there's, you know, light years of space in between them, conceptually. All right, and you do see that, you see them tied together in the Zivach. Okay, so, good. That is, I think, just about all I had to say about the peace offering. Anybody have any further questions or comments about the peace offering before we start the sin offering? Okay, Now let's consider, we've got a couple more sacrifices left. And I need to make a correction here on the other side of the board. When I was doing my initial studying for this, you'll see as we read these next two offerings, the sin offering and the guilt offering use very, very similar language. And I find them kind of difficult to distinguish at times. And in some of the research I had done, I had heard it explained that in the guilt offering, it's generally something that you commit in ignorance and it is then presented to you later. There is one type of guilt offering for that. That is one of the sins for which the guilt offering makes atonement. Right? But it is not just sins of ignorance. It also includes another criterion, which we'll see when we get there. The sin offering and the guilt offering are both offered for unintentional sin, though we find the same language used between both offerings. But as we read, you'll see that the offerings themselves are different. They are referred to as two distinct offerings. So let's start with the sin offering. All right, the sin offering takes up more space. We'll be on the sin offering longer than the guilt offering. Leviticus chapter 4. Leviticus chapter 4. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, saying, if anyone sins unintentionally in any of the Lord's commandments about things not to be done, and does any one of them, if it is the anointed priest who sins, thus bringing guilt on the people, then he shall offer for the sin that he has committed a bull from the herd without blemish to the Lord for a sin offering. He shall bring the bull to the entrance of the tent of meeting before the Lord, and lay his hand on the head of the bull, and kill the bull before the Lord. And the anointed priest shall take some of the blood of the bull and bring it into the tent of meeting. And the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle part of the blood seven times before the Lord in front of the veil of the sanctuary. And the priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of fragrant incense before the Lord that is in the tent of meeting. And all the rest of the blood of the bull he shall pour out at the base of the altar of burnt offering that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting." All right, so already we see some differences between this and the sacrifices we've already read of. What usually happens to the blood in the other sacrifices? I mean, most of it is poured out at the altar. Here, you have the sprinkling in front of the veil in the holy place. You have blood placed on the horns of the altar of incense. And then you have blood poured out at the base of the altar of burnt offering out in the courtyard. "And all the fat of the bull of the sin offering he shall remove from it, and the fat that covers the entrails, and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them at the loins, and the long lobe of the liver that he shall remove with the kidneys, just as these are taken from the ox of the sacrifice of the peace offerings. And the priest shall burn them on the altar of burnt offering. But the skin of the bull, and all its flesh, with its head, its legs, its entrails, and its dung, all the rest of the bull, he shall carry outside the camp to a clean place, to the ash heap, and shall burn it up on a fire of wood. On the ash heap it shall be burned up." All right, so already we will begin to see some differences here. It's not a whole offering, but the rest of the offering, like, nothing happens to it. You take it outside of the camp to a clean place and you burn it up. It's not taken as any kind of meal or anything. And it's not offered as a burnt offering, right? Don't get this wrong. Just because it's being burnt up doesn't mean it's being offered as a burnt offering. It's only the fat that is the burnt offering. Now, unlike what we've seen with the other sacrifices, where the pattern has been essentially, here are your different options for different animals, and the procedure is basically the same for all of the animals. Here we're going to notice that the pattern of this offering is laid out differently. All right, so in the first part, this sin offering is for if it is the anointed priest who sins. All right, let's pick up in verse 13. if the whole congregation of Israel sins unintentionally, and the thing is hidden from the eyes of the assembly, and they do any one of the things that by the Lord's commandments ought not be done, and they realize their guilt, when the sin which they have committed becomes known, the assembly shall offer a bull from the herd for a sin offering, and bring it in front of the tent of meeting. And the elders of the congregation shall lay their hands on the head of the bull before the Lord, and the bull shall be killed before the Lord. Then the anointed priest shall bring some of the blood of the bull into the tent of meeting. The priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle it seven times before the Lord in front of the veil. He shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar that is in the tent of meeting before the Lord. And the rest of the blood he shall pour out at the base of the altar of burnt offering that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting. All right, so far this is pretty much identical to the offering in the event that the sinner is the anointed priest. Except now it's the elders of the congregation presenting the offering. They lay their hands on the bull. Thus he shall do with the bull. Oh, sorry, I skipped verse 19. All its fat he shall take from it and burn on the altar. Thus he shall do with the bull. As he did with the bull of the sin offering, he shall do with this. And the priest shall make atonement for them, and they shall be forgiven. And he shall carry the bull outside the camp and burn it up as he burned the first bull. It is the sin offering for the assembly. All right, so again, pretty well identical. When a leader sins, doing unintentionally any one of all the things that the command, that by the commandments of the Lord his God ought not to be done, and realizes his guilt, or the sin which he has committed is made known to him, he shall bring as his offering a goat, a male without blemish, and shall lay his hand on the head of the goat and kill it in the place where they kill the burnt offering before the Lord. It is a sin offering. All right, so again, we see that now we're moving through different classes of people, right? You start with the anointed priest, then you have sin for the whole congregation. Now it's one of the leaders. And now we've noticed that the sacrifice itself is changed. Rather than being a bull, it is a male goat. All right, and the rest of the procedure is the same. All right, he's going to take the blood, sprinkle it, put some on the horns of the altar, poured the rest out at the base of the altar burnt offering. The fat's going to be burned on the altar. Let's see, I don't think that this mentions specifically what's going to happen with the rest of the animal, but by this point, we know, right? We're able to read patterns. The rest of the, well, actually, I'm about to get ahead of myself. I'm not going to say anything. Verse 27. If any one of the common people sins unintentionally in doing any one of the things that by the Lord's commandments ought not to be done and realizes his guilt, or the sin which he has committed is made known to him, he shall bring for his offering a goat, a female without blemish, for his sin which he has committed. All right, so now we notice, again, we're kind of moving down the line here. Not one of the leaders, but one of the commoners. And now instead of it being a bull or a male goat, it's a female goat for a sacrifice. He shall lay his hand on the head of the sin offering and kill the offering in the place of burnt offering. The priest shall take some of its blood with his finger, put it on the horns of the altar of burnt offering, and pour out all the rest of its blood at the base of the altar. And all its fat he shall remove, as the fat is removed from the peace offerings, and the priest shall burn it on the altar for a pleasing aroma to the Lord. And the priest shall make atonement for him, and he shall be forgiven. Again, the text doesn't tell us what happens with the rest of the body yet. Verse 32, if he brings a lamb as his offering for a sin offering, he shall bring a female without blemish, and lay his hand on the head of the sin offering, kill it for a sin offering in the place where they kill the burnt offering. Then the priest shall take some of the blood of the sin offering with his finger, put it on the horns of the altar of burnt offering, and pour out all of the rest of its blood at the base of the altar. And notice, by the way, by this point, now the priest is not even going into the holy place. Now the blood is not being put on the altar of incense, but on the altar of burnt offering out in the courtyard. All its fat he shall remove as the fat of the lamb is removed from the sacrifice of peace offerings, and the priest shall burn it on the altar on top of the Lord's food offerings, and the priest shall make atonement for him for the sin which he has committed, and he shall be forgiven. All right, now, we're pretty much out of time. Chapter 5, we're going to get a little bit of an interlude that shows us what kinds of sins qualify for this kind of offering. Moses is going to give us some examples. And then he's going to pick up again in chapter 5, verse 7. moving basically even further down the totem pole. All right, so we've talked about the anointed priest, the whole congregation, leaders, commoners. Then in verse 7, someone who can't afford a lamb will bring two turtle doves. So this is the commandment for a poor person. Verse 11, if he can't afford two turtle doves, right, he doesn't even have two birds to rub together, then he shall bring for the sin that he has committed, a tenth of an ephah of fine flour for a sin offering. All right, so it moves all the way down to the very, very poor. Now, we'll leave you with a few questions to ponder over. This is different than what we have seen with the other sacrifices up to this point. Now, instead of just giving us options for different animals, now it is phrased explicitly in terms of status and wealth. Spend some time thinking about why this sacrifice has that kind of provision in it, where it runs the whole social gamut, whereas burnt offerings and peace offerings, you don't have that kind of provision made. So give some thought to that. Thank you so much for your kind attention this morning and your questions and comments. We'll pick this up on Thursday.